2012 special. Day 3 with Christina Smith. Welcome to the third day of the Jogcast NAM specials. Today there have been sessions on loads of different aspects of astronomy and astrophysics, including binary star systems, cosmology, exoplanets, and the nature of galaxies. I managed to catch up with a few of the speakers and poster presenters earlier today. I'm here now with Professor Bob Nicol from Portsmouth University, who is giving a talk about the Dark Energy Survey. Can you give us a little bit of background information on what dark energy is?
Sure. It's going to be pretty quick. We don't know what it is.
Okay.
It's appeared about a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Some astronomers were observing distant supernova and appeared that they were moving quicker away from us than expected. Mm-hmm. And that caused us to reevaluate our model of the universe. And we now have a model of the universe where the expansion of the universe appears to be accelerating, not slowing down. And this is a bit odd.
Yeah.
Because when you usually think about gravity, as you've heard, gravity sucks. Mm-hmm. And so it pulls things together. And so we would have expected that the stuff in the universe, the normal matter, would have actually slowed down the acceleration. Mm-hmm. Whereas in reality, what we do seem to be seeing is that that expansion is getting faster and faster and faster.
Okay.
So what we've had to do is look for something that we can put in the universe that kind of acts as a repulsive force or an anti-gravity. And that thing we call dark energy, so it's repulsive and causes the acceleration of the universe. And one option is this famous thing called Einstein's cosmological constant. And so that's our favorite model for dark energy. But there are as many models of dark energy as there are astronomers.
Okay. So there's lots of different options to be pursued.
Absolutely.
And the Dark Energy Survey, is that looking for evidence of it or looking for...
So I think we're coming out of a decade where we're now accepting the fact that the universe, 75% of the energy in the universe is caught up in this dark energy.
Okay.
So it's the majority of the energy in the universe. So now I think we've accepted it. We've had a decade of being skeptical and going, oh, I don't believe that, to a point now where we really have to understand it.
Yeah.
And so the Dark Energy Survey, I like to say, is the first survey that really starts to understand what dark energy could be, rather than just confirming its existence.
What's it actually going to be looking at?
So what the Dark Energy Survey has is it has four probes.
Okay.
So it's going to use four different objects to try and understand this dark energy. So the first one are clusters of galaxies. So it's going to try and find clumps of matter out there in the universe. And the Dark Energy Survey will see further and wider than any other survey to date.
Mm-hmm.
So it will see lots of these things. Okay. It's also going to use a technique called gravitational lensing, which looks for the distortions of distant galaxies because of the nearby matter. It's going to just look at the clustering of galaxies on very large scales. And the one thing I'm mostly interested in is it's also going to use these wonderful supernova that were used to originally confirm the existence of dark energy.
So the instrument that's being used, is it one instrument? Is it a collection of instruments?
So it's one instrument. It's a brand new camera that we built. This thing is awesome. Okay. Imagine a camera that's the size of a settee.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
And pretty
huge. Pretty huge. Okay. It's a ton. Okay. So it's big.
Wow.
All right. And it has 570 megapixels.
Okay. 570 megapixels.
570. So try and buy that in Currys, all right? You can't go out and buy this thing, all right? It's an order of magnitude than what you can get commercially.
Okay.
And so that's what we've been building over the last few years.
Okay, wow. That sounds like an awesome instrument. And this camera, is it being used from the ground, or is it something that's being used up in space? Or
so we're using it now on the ground with a relatively old telescope, the CTIO 4-meter telescope in Chile.
Okay.
So we refurbished that telescope and putting this camera on.
Yeah.
And we're going to have 5 years using that ground-based telescope to survey most of the southern sky.
And you're hoping in that you'll...
The numbers we expect are we're going to detect about 300 million galaxies.
Okay.
About 4,000 supernova, and somewhere in the region of about 100,000 clusters of galaxies.
Oh, wow.
And the key is you not only do you need that large number of objects, but the camera also provides the best images we can capture from the ground.
Okay.
Because some of the techniques we're trying to use, like this weak lensing technique, really does need pristine images. You know those images you see from the Hubble Space Telescope?
Yeah,
they need sharp, they've got to be sharp, because we're going to measure the shapes of those galaxies.
Okay.
So it's not just that we want to see the galaxies, we want to measure things about them. We want to measure their shape, their color, their orientation,
mm-hmm.
and that requires slightly better data than we've had to date. So for the next 5 years, we'll be using the Dark Energy Survey. That, I think, will give us a clue as to whether this thing called dark energy is what is the cosmological constant,
mm-hmm.
this thing that Einstein had put in his equations now 80 years ago. All the present data points in that direction, but we're not 100% sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Dark Energy Survey will tell us if it's the cosmological constant. But that really doesn't satisfy us, because we don't actually know what the cosmological constant is.
Okay.
So it's like moving the goalposts, really. It's saying, you know, it's relabeling the problem at some level. But in the next decade, we're going to have a satellite called Euclid,
mm-hmm.
which is now the same size as DES in terms of the size of the camera.
But
imagine putting that into space now.
Okay, so it's going to...
So imagine having HST images over the whole sky.
Wow, that would be amazing.
Imagine the Hubble Deep Field across the whole sky. This is what Euclid's going to deliver. And what Euclid will do is it will test one final thing about this dark energy
mm-hmm.
problem. One way out is to say that Einstein's theory of gravity is incomplete. It's not that it's wrong, because it works. It works very well on this Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get on cosmological scales, general relativity may not actually be the correct theory of gravity.
Okay.
Euclid will nail that. Euclid will be one of the definitive tests of general relativity on cosmological scales. So over the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to go from DES telling us whether it's the cosmological constant
mm-hmm.
to 15 years from now, Euclid telling us whether it's general relativity.
Wow, so they're both really going to help our knowledge of dark energy and what it really is.
Exactly.
Sounds absolutely fantastic, and I wish you all the best with it.
Thanks very much.
I'm here now with Kelly Hambleton, who's a PhD student at UCLan, and has just given a talk on heartbeat stars. What are heartbeat stars?
So heartbeat stars are a new class of eccentric binary system.
Mm-hmm.
They demonstrate increases in the light as opposed to the usual decrease from the eclipse. And this is because the two stars are interacting with each other to the point that they deform each other, and you see a greater surface area of the stars, and so instead of the usual dip for an eclipse, you get an increase in light at the time of closest approach.
Okay, so you said that they were an eccentric pair, so that means that they're on a non-circular orbit.
Yes.
Yeah. And you said that they eclipse, they're two stars that are going to pass in front or behind of each other? Is there anything?
Okay, so they don't always eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
So as they pass close to each other, you get the increase in light. Some of them do actually eclipse, so you also get a dip in the light
mm-hmm.
and an increase in the light. Other interesting things that you can see is tidally induced pulsations. So you get a kind of ringing, and it's because you get pulsations that occur on a set number of times per orbit. So you'll get five pulsations within an orbit, and this is a concise number. So when you fold the light curve, you'll actually see...
What do you mean by fold the light curve?
When you phase the light curve. So if you have a time series of, say, 50 days and the orbit is 2 days,
mm-hmm.
then you fold the light curve every 2 days of worth of orbits, so you have just one full orbit.
So you're sort of like stacking it.
Yeah. On top of each other, yes, essentially. Then you still see the pulsations, and that's because they occur the same number of times every orbit.
Okay, and you said they were tidally caused, so that's just caused by the other star interacting.
Yes, yeah, so stars pulsate naturally. Most stars pulsate naturally. And it's because of the different cavities within the stars and the different ionization zones within the stars, and that decides what kind of pulsations the stars will have, the periods of the pulsation, so how long they last. And if the period of a pulsation is similar or very, very close to the period of the orbit, or if there are, say, for example, you get five pulsations within one orbit, so it's a precise number, then the tide and the pulsation will interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And this causes what you call resonance. So the star, the pulsations get a kick every time they get close to the star. So you get like this tidal interaction, and these pulsations have an increased amplitude to what they would usually have if there wasn't a binary system.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for starting to talk to me. And yeah, have a nice rest of the conference.
All right, thank you.
And finally, I'm here with Natalie Sukushpek, who is presenting a poster about her work, which is entitled The Search for Rare Objects in UKIDS. So first of all, what's UKIDS?
It's a wide field near-infrared survey that goes deeper than TUMAS, so can detect fainter sources.
Okay. Is it done from space?
No, it's located in Hawaii.
Okay,
on
nice.
On top of Mauna Kea. So we got to go there and observe, which was very nice.
And these rare objects, what sort of things are they?
I'm looking for either objects that are very far away, like mm-hmm. very high redshift quasars,
yeah.
which would give us an idea about constraining the history of the universe or give us more information about reionization. But on the other hand, I also look for galactic objects that are very cool, because they get picked out in the near-infrared as well. I'm looking for Y brown dwarfs, which are the coolest brown dwarfs, with temperatures between 300 and 500 Kelvin. And because the temperatures are so low, they're very close to the temperatures of exoplanets.
Okay.
So it could give us insight into the atmospheres of exoplanets.
Okay, that's awesome.
And then I'm also looking for ultra-cool white dwarfs, which are the end of a star. And I'm looking for white dwarfs with, temperatures around 4,000 Kelvin or below.
Okay, that's... Yeah.
Yeah, because the way white dwarfs work, the cooler they get, the slower the cooling is.
Mm-hmm.
So if an object is this cool, it means it's very old.
Okay.
Which would help us constraining the age of the Milky Way. I was also searching for a completely unknown class of objects, like something we didn't expect to find.
Mm-hmm. So something you weren't expecting to find?
We didn't know what we were really searching for. That's why we tried to... We didn't look for specific things.
Okay.
We used chi-square template fitting to fit templates to a data set of over 4.7 million objects.
Okay.
And if the fit was bad to any of the given templates, which were stars, white dwarfs, quasars of any sort below the redshift of 5 or 5.9,
mm-hmm.
Or brown dwarfs that are warmer than, say, 500 Kelvin,
mm-hmm.
then they were fitted well with the templates we had and were removed from our sample, and we just picked out the objects that couldn't be fitted. So they are considered rare and interesting.
Okay.
So we hoped to find some sort of unknown class of objects, which we haven't detected as of yet. But we have picked out some moderately interesting objects.
Okay. Just one thing that you said earlier is you used a chi-squared template. Is that some sort of statistical analysis tool?
Yes, that is.
Okay, cool. So it's just using statistics. So.
Yeah. It's a statistical tool that also considers errors, which is very important because obviously every observation has errors.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I wish you all the best in the rest of your work and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much. I will.
In her interview, Natalie mentions high redshift quasars, and just to clarify this, these are quasars that are really long way away, which means that they're looking at them from a long way back in time. Specifically, she mentions quasars that are redshift of about 5, which means quasars which are around about 12 billion light years away, which is a pretty long way away. And finally, one of today's press releases concerns a huge tornado which has been discovered on the Sun by Dr. Jing Li and Dr. Hugh Morgan of the University of Aberystwyth. the Atmospheric Imaging Assembly, which is an instrument, it's a telescope, on board the Solar Dynamic Observatory, was used to observe the sun on the 25th of September in 2011. And this actually observed superheated gases, which were being sucked up from the base of a prominence up into the upper atmospheres, upper parts of the atmosphere of the sun, similar to that of a tornado, which is really, really cool. And there's a video being shown about it later today, and that sounds amazing. And I will link to more information on the show notes so that you can find out some more about this. And that brings us to the end of day three of NAMM. The editor and producer was Christina Smith. So I hope you've enjoyed it, and until tomorrow, jot on.